John, I hear that you've been thinking about where our energy has come from recently.
I haven't just been thinking about it recently, Chris, but in the last decade, it is remarkable to note that over 40% of our new power plant capacity, and increasingly more of that, is coming from renewable energy sources alone. And the remainder of that is pretty much coming from natural gas. In other words, there's almost no new coal power plants being built in this country in the last decade.
Also, no nuclear power plants or other facilities.
There hasn't been a new nuclear plant built in a long time, and the only one that's under construction in Georgia continues to experience construction delays, increasing its cost.
So the other thing that came to mind when you said that was that in the last decade was entirely after the year 2000, which still I find amazing.
Yes. In fact, it's not even that close to the year 2000 anymore.
It really isn't. Welcome to another Building Local Power podcast from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. We're going to talk about clean power today and the clean power plan from the Obama administration that the Trump administration has just wiped out, and whether we should freak out or celebrate or how we should react in general to this monumental change in policy. Is that right, John?
Yeah, it is a big change in policy, but I think it would be important to note that we should all take a deep breath before we consider the implications of this.
There's nothing better than a podcast that talks about taking a deep breath. That was John Farrell, who runs our energy work. I'm Chris Mitchell, and also Carly Weinman, who is here with a bemused look on her face and does all the work that John takes credit for. Welcome back, Carly.
Hi, Chris.
So it's great to have all podcast veterans back on Building Local Power. So let's just take a quick step back and talk about what was the clean power plan from the Obama administration in brief.
So it was really just a set of rules that would guide states on the course to reducing greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. And so it was going to particularly affect states that had a lot of coal power plants that were disproportionately putting a lot of greenhouse gas emissions into the air, and was going to require them to come up with a plan. And the nice thing is that the state was able to choose what that plan was, but they would have to hit a certain target for emissions reductions. So when I said at the beginning, we need to take a deep breath about what's happening here, that's for two reasons. One is that because it was a fairly complex rule, there's a process for walking it back. I heard one commentator on the radio say, creating the rules was like walking up a set of stairs, and undoing them means you have to walk down the same set of stairs. Changes in the rules will take some time. And the second thing is that for states that were agreeable to the Clean Power Plan, which is to say they wanted to do something anyway, they're going to go ahead and move and find ways to implement those rules or find other ways of meeting those greenhouse gas emissions regardless. So I think we have kind of two hopeful elements here. One is that it will take a while to undo this, and the other is that many states will move ahead whether or not the federal government is continuing to compel them to do so.
And Carly, I just want to ask you a question as someone who came to us as a reporter covering a lot of business. I think of you as someone who knows a lot about markets. It strikes me that all of this change in policy, the market isn't sort of thinking, oh, carbon is free in the future. It seems like in many ways, not much has changed.
Okay, so utilities are increasingly moving toward clean energy, and they have been for a long time based on the economics. So it's not like the Clean Power Plan upended the marketplace, and as John said, it's not like this decision by President Trump will upend the marketplace. Fracking is, I think, a great and instructive example of this. Certainly that compounded the shift away from coal, and that had nothing to do with the policy that we're talking about here today. So the bottom line is that nothing is going to save coal from these economics, and even if natural gas gets more expensive, renewables remain on a trajectory that makes them increasingly accessible and attractive.
Well, that's a good sign. It's also a sign, I just sort of wonder a little bit about the hype on both sides. To be glib, investors are smarter than voters, and I don't think investors have a sense like, hey, let's go build three coal power plants now.
It's funny you should say that, Chris, because one of the tools that Carly and I use and many others in our field is an analysis done by the investment bank Lazard, at least I think that's the name. And they do this every year, and it compares the cost of energy from different power plants. And what you can see in their most recent one, which is like version 10 of their analysis, is essentially that renewable energy is the cheapest form of electricity across the board, that solar and wind And of course, things like energy efficiency are cheaper than any other kind of power plant you can build, whether it's a nuclear one, a coal one, or a natural gas one. So when Carly's talking about the economics being in the driver's seat here in the wake of the Clean Power Plan or its reversal, you know, like you said, the folks informing the investors, the investment banks, are essentially saying, put your money on renewables. That's the cheap stuff.
Well, and it strikes me from the stat you brought from the beginning, 40% of energy gains over the last 10 years coming from these renewable energies, this clean energy. It just sort of, maybe I'm stuck in thinking about this from a 20-year-ago perspective, which was like, oh, people are saying, oh, sure, solar's doubling, but it's a fraction of a fraction. It doesn't matter. It's not adding up. It seems like it's adding up now.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, if you look on our website, Carly's updating every quarter our analysis of new power plant capacity, you can see this chart went from being almost all purple and black, which was representing fossil fuels, to this big bright band of blue, which represents wind power, which has been most of that new capacity. And in the past couple, 3-4 years, all of a sudden there are these big bars of orange and red, which represent large scale and small scale solar. And so it is really adding up. And although on an annual basis, the amount of total energy, electricity that we get from that is still relatively small, it's growing very quickly. And so it shows up first in these charts around capacity. In the next couple of years, we'll start to see that in terms of how much energy we get on an annual basis.
A lot of that growth is rooted in state policies that support it and encourage it, and not necessarily in any action that happens or doesn't happen at the federal level. So I think that just goes to show that we're really seeing movement in terms of policy that advances or inhibits growth in renewables and clean energy. That's not happening at the federal level per se.
When you say it's at the state level, I'm curious. I immediately start thinking, oh, well, probably like California and blue states. But then I remember Texas and even Iowa. I'm not really sure what color Iowa is anymore. Yellow for corn, maybe. I'm curious what states in particular have really been driving this, because I'm guessing it's not all states.
No, it's not all states, but there's no question that there's some partisan lean to the states that are driving a lot of this. California, for example, happens to be a very deep blue state, but it also happens to be a state that has a really good renewable energy resource. So in fact, I would say that is in some ways even more powerful of a driver. So you take Iowa, for example, regardless of its politics, it has an incredible wind resource. And in fact, the policy that got its wind industry started expired 10 or 20 years ago. So all of the development in wind power in Iowa, which is one of the nation leaders on a per capita basis, is because wind simply is a really cheap resource for supplying electricity needs, because wind blows a lot in Iowa. On the other hand, you have states like Minnesota or Colorado or California or New York, where we've enacted policies that are pushing utilities toward renewables. Of course, the analysis shows in retrospect that that was a very cost-effective choice. And then you're also seeing advances in places like Arizona or Nevada or Texas, where it's not really policy driven, it's just economics. So in West Texas, you have tens of thousands of megawatts of wind power because it's a very good wind resource, but increasingly solar. Excellent solar resource in Arizona and Nevada, New Mexico, driving a lot of solar adoption there.
And so one last thing on this area and the economics is, you mentioned that it was a good bet to force the utilities to go with the renewables. Now, in the past, you and I have talked a lot about what was the best way of subsidizing these forms of power, a feed-in tariff, a production tax credit, the problems associated with some of these. Are these things unnecessary now?
I don't think it's unnecessary to still have policy that is helping the transition toward renewable energy. What I would say is that the kinds of policy we need are different. So whereas a decade ago, it was really important to sort of throw money at it, to get the industry built up, to build the manufacturing experience, to get the supply chains developed, to get people trained in and employed and build all of that part of the installation and manufacturing process. What I think has happened now is that we need to figure out ways to maintain competitive markets. So, for example, a 1978 federal law called PURPA has required utilities to buy electricity from competitive sources ever since the late 1970s. It came out of the oil crisis and the desire to find more economical power sources. Well, that law is still in force in all 50 states, requiring us to look at economical sources. And utilities, now that they are facing competition from renewable energy resources produced by non-utility participants, are saying, hey, we want to get rid of that law. And so there are still ways in which the entrenched interests, whether it's monopoly utility companies or the fossil fuel industry, are trying to push back against renewables. And we need to hold firm on market access on the basis of, you know, cost competitiveness.
One last thing before we get to our surprise call-in guest, which is a quote from the past. I wanted to note that I was listening to Charlie Sykes last week. He has a show on Indivisible, which is this joint production of, I think, Minnesota Public Radio, WNYC, and others. It's first 100 days of the Trump presidency talk radio. Charlie Sykes is a conservative talk show host who is from Wisconsin. He's a very interesting guy. He was making a case that he felt like the Clean Power Plan would have been really bad for Wisconsin. It would have cost, in his words, I think, billions of dollars in extra costs to ratepayers, and it would have therefore have been bad to business. And I'm just curious how you would respond to that. And I think it looks like Carly's all ready to, you know, offer some context.
I think it's fair to say that in some states like Wisconsin, utilities might have made poor bets on infrastructure like coal plants in the past, but now it's up to regulators to hold them accountable. And part of that is the clean power standards that may or may not be imposed by the federal government. But part of that is, holding utilities to sensible, responsible economics like the kind John has been talking about, because it can cost ratepayers a lot of money as well to stay the course that we've seen from these maybe more short-sighted utilities in the past.
I'd just like to add too that there's a couple other factors here. One, in terms of costs, is that the health and environmental costs of our power system has always been socialized. So you have private profits for utilities building these power plants and then socializing the costs. The health and environmental costs.
Like,
and so,
could you just explain a couple of those?
Yeah. So, for example, mercury pollution, which from coal power plants in particular, gets into lakes and streams and waters, gets consumed by fish or absorbed by fish, and then raises the toxicity to the level that we can't eat fish anymore, or particularly vulnerable populations like children and pregnant women.
Right. They only get it like once a week or something like that.
Exactly. So that's been one of the costs that we've had, and certainly not one that we pay for on our utility bills. The second thing I would say, though, too, and this is a bit of a criticism of the Clean Power Plan, is that as an administrative rule, and it really is the only way that Obama had to implement it because he didn't have a Congress willing to work with him, and coming from the top down at the federal level, it really just applies sort of brute force to utilities to make them change the way that they're doing business. A lot of the economical opportunities that we have for renewables, though, aren't from the utilities. They're from the bottom up. They're from consumers putting solar on their own households. They're from community solar like we have in Minnesota or New York or Maryland. They're from, you know, distributed energy production that could use that 1978 PURPA law to sell power competitively to the utility company. And so I think one of the potential costs that, you know, I don't know if this is what Charlie Sykes was getting to or not, but I think one of the potential problems with the Clean Power Plan was the fact that this top-down kind of bureaucratic solution would have made it difficult for some of those things to come to market that might be much more cost-effective than asking utilities to turn the ship.
With that, we want to take a call that comes direct to us from the town hall debate between presidential candidate Clinton and presidential candidate Trump. Ken Bone, I think you're on the line. What did you want to ask?
What steps will your energy policy take to meet our energy needs while at the same time remaining environmentally friendly and minimizing job loss for fossil power plant workers?
Candidate John, tell us what your plan would include.
First of all, I just want to point out that Ken Bone got picked on a lot in the media or highlighted in the media for the fact that he had a bright red sweater, and then a whole bunch of other stuff went on. And it was really one of the most intelligent questions that we've had about energy policy in a long time, because
I think that's probably why he got picked on. I mean, honestly, I just don't see our media being able to really deal with those sorts of intelligent, layered questions, which aren't just sort of red meat for one side or the other.
Right. And that's true. There wasn't a lot of red meat for either side in this particular question. It was a very well nuanced one. And I think the most important part of his question really was around this notion of both environmentally friendly energy and then what happens with fossil fuel power plant workers. So there's a recognition in that question that we are moving away from fossil fuels. And despite that, you see in the recent news here about the Clean Power Plan, this assumption that somehow we're going to roll back these regulations and it's going to allow these, in particular, coal mining and coal jobs to come back. And the truth is, in the last 50 years, employment in the coal mining sector has dropped by about two-thirds, even as production has more than doubled. And that has nothing to do with renewable energy, because there weren't renewables on the system in the 60s and 70s and 80s and even the early 90s.
It's Wyoming's fault, actually, with the Powder River Basin coal and the coal from out west and the mountaintop removal coal. It's all highly capital now.
Right. And so, unfortunately, that's something that candidate and then President Trump has not been really interested in getting into the nuance of. And so he's really exploiting the job losses from automation in the coal mining sector in order to unpack and destroy these environmental regulations. I think the crux of this then is that, you know, in the same way that some people say, well, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones, that the coal age is going to end not because we run out of coal, but because we have cheaper ways to produce our energy than we did before. And so ultimately, you know, the issue here is, what is it that we can do? What is a reasonable approach to our energy system that accomplishes these goals of environmental sensitivity, meeting our energy needs, and respecting fossil fuel power plant workers and fossil fuel workers? And the Clean Power Plan reversal does none of these things. It doesn't mean that we will get environmentally friendly energy. In fact, it undermines a regulation in favor of it. It doesn't really help us in terms of cost-effective energy either. In fact, the biggest winners being talked about in the news here are coal mining companies, which will be able to sell more coal to existing power plants, perhaps, at the expense of the workers, for whom often end up being on the losing end of bankruptcy filings, for example, where they lose their pensions and their health care and everything else. So what can we do? There were a number of things that we actually outlined that we wrote about on our website in light of his Ken Bone's question at the debate. And there are a couple of things. One is, as I've said earlier, reinforcing the access for renewable energy to the market. Number two is figuring out how we can retrain people from the fossil fuel sector to work in those jobs and to make sure that those are good jobs, whether that's helping unions organize in that area like they have the fossil fuel industry, whether that's coal mining jobs or power plant jobs, or just making sure that we have a way to transition folks into those jobs that are generally good paying. And the third thing is that we just have to admit that the fossil fuel jobs are going away, that there's nothing that we can do from a federal regulation perspective other than maybe something like Wyoming tried to do recently, which was to pass a law prohibiting utilities from building renewable energy power plants. It would be incredibly expensive and have all of these adverse societal effects from pollution and on down, but it might keep them working for at least a little bit longer, maybe, except that as the cost of energy went up from the utility company, people are going to put solar on the rooftop and stop buying it from the utility. So there's really no saving those jobs. So how do we have a just transition? How do we help those folks?
So I feel like I often hear people talking about job retraining. We've heard about this from NAFTA. We've heard about this from TPP and trade agreements. And people always talk about how the people who end up losing their jobs can just get new jobs. But it seems like when you actually look at those programs, they're hard to pull off. So what do we have to do to actually make sure they're going to work in this instance?
Well, we give a little more detail in the post that we produced in response to Ken's question.
Which I believe was a deep dive to answer Ken Bone's energy question at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance's webpage on ILSR.org.
Yes, thank you, Chris. And I think what's a key here to understand is that retraining is just one piece of this, that we need wage insurance, which means ensuring that the folks that are in these jobs can maintain their current wages for a set period of time, maybe at least 5 years. So there is a reasonable period of transition. The second one is that we have that retraining assistance, but it might also include relocation assistance, because it may be that the jobs for renewable energy are not in Appalachia like the jobs were for coal mining or for working in a power plant. A similar issue actually came up recently in Minnesota about the potential closure of a coal power plant in Becker, a small rural community. And another thing that we have to consider too is not just the outcome for these workers, but the outcome for the communities, because these big power plants are a sizable portion of a community's property tax revenue and a sizable presence in the community. And so what can we do for those communities? In Minnesota, we had a bill passed that said, we'll build a new power plant there to replace that. It's $1 billion ratepayer subsidy for a town of 2,000 people in order to maintain that town's character. There are probably less expensive ways we can do that. We outline a couple of them in our research. It comes from some very good, very thorough work done by the American Prospect.
There are a number of these workers, a fairly fairly large proportion that are going to be hitting retirement age before we really need to be all in on this transition. So it's not necessarily going to be a one-to-one, we need to find a new job and a solution for every single worker. And while I acknowledge that a just transition is of paramount importance, this is and has been a shrinking industry for a long time. So that evolution in the fossil fuel industry is, I think, important to remember in this context.
Right. Actually, it just strikes me whenever I hear people talk about how great these jobs are, that one of the things I always remember in growing up in eastern Pennsylvania, I mean, I didn't know any miners, certainly, but there was always a sense that people worked hard, dirty jobs, not because they loved it and it was awesome, but because they wanted to make sure their kids had a good education and had all the opportunities that they didn't have, and they could go on and not spend their life working in a job which was unsafe in many cases. So I think it's an important context to bear in mind. But I wanted to end with a question of hope, which is, you know, we talk around the office a lot about whether things are heading in a direction that's one of despair or not. And I'm curious, when you look at this, and we've elected someone that I think no one in this office supports as president, who's doing a lot of damage and to the things that we care about. And yet, it seems to me like it's actually, maybe he can't do that much damage because we have local leadership and that sort of thing. I'm just curious, you know, what you take away from it, Carly.
I would say I take a lot of heart in the local leadership that we have and in many communities around the country since November. With regard to these clean energy issues, I think we've seen a tremendous willingness on behalf of local leaders to take ownership of this issue and to really make it their own in a way that maybe they weren't as active about before November, but now, especially in light of the recent actions regarding the Clean Power Plan, I think that there's a new kind of emphasis that really opens the door to local action that can really deliver the most meaningful results here.
So do we have any recommendations for people to check out for reading or listening or viewing or anything like that?
There was a really remarkable piece recently published by the New York Times on Uber, looking at its business model and the tension between the company's interest and the driver's interest. They had some interactive features that allowed you to kind of play around with, like, well, what happens if there are more drivers or less drivers? But it's just, it's a really stunning revelation of what the sharing economy is about, and whether or not Uber is really good for the people who are working for it, whether or not they're employees or not. But I highly recommend it as a good way to get some insight on that.
And so I'd like to suggest a recommendation from Carly and I, which is the video that you recommended we watch. You remember the name of it? The 1 hour presentation about the electric vehicles.
Oh, and yes. Autonomous driving. It's Tony Seba did a presentation. He's the author of a book called Clean Disruption. I don't recall the exact title of the YouTube video from 2016 for the presentation he gave, but it is a remarkable look at the way that the clean energy economy will be changing thanks to Silicon Valley technology over the next decade.
Great. Thank you both.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
That was John Farrell and Carly Weinman joining Christopher Mitchell for episode 15 of the Building Local Power podcast. John and Carly work on our Energy Democracy Initiative, and Christopher heads up the Community Broadband Networks Initiative. Check out John and Carly's work at ilsr.org/initiatives/energy.
Hey, everyone. Please tell your friends, tell others who might be interested about this show. If you have a chance to rate us on iTunes, please do. Several people already have. We really appreciate all of the comments, and we really appreciate you taking the time to listen to us.
We also encourage you to subscribe to this podcast and all of our other podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also sign up for our monthly newsletter at ilsr.org. Thanks to Dysfunction Al for the music licensed through Creative Commons. The song is Funk Interlude. This is Lisa Gonzalez from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Thanks again for listening to episode 15 of the Building Local Power podcast.